Good morning and welcome to this January 20th, 2020 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org and we are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, however you consume your podcasts. We are under Writers on Writing. You can find Barbara at penonfire.com. On her site are links to past shows, information about upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. You can find me at mariestone.com. Also, archives of past shows are up there. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. We've asked you to write with your thoughts, and some of you have requested more short stories. Some of you requested more science fiction, so that is how we are spending our morning. I'm on with the full hour with Alexander Weinstein with his second collection of dystopian short stories, Universal Love. Alexander Weinstein is the author of Children of the New World, which was named a Notable Book of the Year by the New York Times, NPR, and Electric Literature. He was on the show with me in September of 2016 talking about that. You can find a copy of that podcast in our archives. He is a recipient of the Sustainable Arts Foundation Award, and his stories have been nominated for the Pushcart Prize and appeared in Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy and Best American Experimental Writing. He's an associate professor of creative writing at Siena Heights University and lectures in the U.S. and Europe. It's his latest, Universal Love. It is another collection of 11 stories set in the near future world where technology has an even deeper hold on us than it does today. It is published by Henry Holt, and it will drive our discussion today. Alexander, welcome back.
Great to be back.
Thanks so much for coming on. So we have the luxury of a little more time today. So I've never really gotten to hear your backstory with writing and kind of how you came to it, where you started. So maybe we start there with your story about becoming a storyteller.
Sure. So it started in third grade where I had an assignment to write Halloween stories. And I began writing these really gory, horrific Halloween stories because I was reading Stephen King at the time and, you know, full of red ink, blood, and all of this. And I turned it in, and the teacher said, these are great. You know, why don't you do another 10? They were, you know, in retrospect, completely horrible stories, so to speak. But it was the beginning for me of realizing that there was this thing that I could potentially be an author. And so I kept writing throughout high school. I went to university for that. And then on to MFA. And I think during all that time, there wasn't, you know, by the time I got to MFA, I got advice on publishing. But until then, I just thought, really, you know, it was the Stephen King path. You wrote a book, you send it off to the publisher, became a bestseller, they sent you a check for $300,000 or $500,000, and, you know, the sky was the limit. And so it's a little more difficult, I found out. And so I started in graduate school, sending individual stories out, receiving lots of rejection at first, you know, 94 rejections before my first acceptance, and then developing as a writer from that until I had my first collection.
Amazing, amazing. And so you kind of, do you kind of credit that early teacher with all of his encouragement and, you know, potentiality? And I think these formative years, I talk to so many writers, and that's kind of where it started, is in these really early grade school years when your imagination is still super open and, you know, you're not as self-censoring as you might be a little bit later on.
And, no, completely.
Yeah, interesting stuff comes out of those years, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, it was such an open sense of play and of encouragement. I was fortunate to have parents that encouraged me in this, so they didn't, you know, ask me questions like, how are you going to make a living, or those kind of critical questions that I think can sometimes thwart young writers or give, you know, sort of strengthen the inner critic. So for a long time, I was just really producing in a stage of inner critic-less producing, which was a wonderful place to be.
Yeah. How critical, how much do you credit your MFA with kind of tied to your success? Do you feel like that's sort of a critical component, or you could have gotten there a different way?
For me, it was. You know, I don't think for all writers that it's a necessity, but I had come out of my undergraduate, I finished at the Naropa School, so the Jack Kerouac School for Disembodied Poetics, which is an amazing school, completely in the Beat poetry tradition, and a really wild school, and I learned a lot of experimentation there. But I hadn't yet learned, you know, again, how to publish, how to make my living as a writer. And so I really felt that the years of being in the MFA program, you know, it's a wonderful thing to be paid, also to have to be trained as a teacher, to get a stipend, and just to work on my own fiction during those years. And so that gave me a kind of incubator where I could see the professional side of it and get a better blueprint of how could I progress as an author.
And we talked last time that it's always been short stories for you, that's kind of the forum where you really feel most comfortable and most driven.
I do, yeah. And, you know, it's a lot of what I read as well. I mean, I certainly read novels, but I just really love the short story form because, one, you can change register, you can change form, you can change voice, character, very quickly. You know, you're not stuck in that for hundreds of pages. And so it lets me try out new experiments, explore, and also work with a kind of beginning, middle, end in a very concise way.
Yeah. Well, since I picked up Children of the New World a few years ago, I've been waiting and waiting for this day. I've been waiting and waiting for the next one to come out because I was such a fan of that book. And this book just feels like it kind of picks up a little bit of where we left off last time and keeps going.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, so I'm going to let you kind of take us into the new collection and talk a little bit, you know, kind of about maybe what was on your mind as you were formulating this collection and you know, if it really stemmed out of the last collection that you felt like you still had more stories to tell in this vein. But kind of take us into the new book.
Yeah, so Universal Love explores what happens to love in this near future where technology has run just slightly more rampant than it is right now. It's really just speculating 5 years, 10 years, 20 years into the future, and takes a look at kind of what is the impact that technology has on intimacy and love in all its different forms, familial love, friendship, romantic love, sexual love. And it does take off, you know, in many ways, Children of the New World was a warning, a kind of, you know, it was my hope that it was a dire warning of be careful where we're heading with technology. We're losing our interpersonal relationships. We're getting addicted. Well, the new book, I think, takes for granted that we already answered that question and decided not to worry, which seems to be where we're at,
right.
I think, as a culture, that we kind of have accepted the addiction. And so it focuses less on the individual problems of the technology being dystopian, but instead how does love survive in a mediated world of technology?
Right. It's funny because I found myself, the last time we talked, we lived in kind of a very different world than we live in now. And, you know, the world has become a little bit more dystopian. We talked in September of 2016, and the election hadn't yet happened. And, you know, kind of regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, you know, I think the doomsday clock just got a little nudge last week towards a little more doomsday. So,
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, we're just in a slightly different place than we were 3.5 years ago. And, all of that, it's funny because, yeah, well, last time we were talking a lot about addiction, and now I feel like we're very invested in technology as almost an escape or as a escape hatch out of some of our current situations so that it's, it gives us a mental place to sometimes rest so we don't have to rest in the real world, maybe. I don't know if that was on your mind, but I'd love for you to talk about how the external world has kind of informed your interior creative world and how much what's going on around us is driving what you're writing.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree with your statement or your diagnosis of why we're using it so much. It's actually in some ways two parts. One is that we do escape into these almost childhood worlds now, right? If you look at the games we're playing and the literally the games we're playing, you know, of video games and virtual reality that spans almost all ages at this point, to the little games that we play on our phones, to even the way that we use social media. I mean, the putting cat noses on our faces and different and dog ears and things like this, and adults are doing this, is a sweet and slightly bizarre phenomenon. And, yeah, the world is getting darker in that way. I mean, we've had such a dark number of years since the election. And I do believe that we want to escape that, right? And so in the new collection, I have this line that all we wanted was a couple hours of uninterrupted scrolling at the end of the night. And I think many of us find ourselves doing that, scrolling almost as though we're scrolling for something to give us hope or entertain us. And that definitely informs the stories. The issue of what is such a dystopian and, for me, horrific couple of years with the president or the impeached president, that has been really difficult to write about. You know, it's hard to do satire or anything because it's so Orwellian already, so you kind of can't overdo it. And that's proven. I have one story in the new collection, Sanctuary, which is probably the only story that really deals with this idea of immigration, right, albeit in the form of aliens crashing our virtual reality systems, these enormous grasshoppers that are seeking asylum, and the way that we then, and the president then, goes to war against these asylum-seeking mantids and grasshoppers. And that was as close as I could get to doing satire or political critique, because I find it a very difficult thing under this administration.
Right, right. The last time we talked about Children of the Lesser World, I had said, you know, you typically, a lot of short story writers that I talk to write 10 or 13 or 20 short stories, and then they kind of see where the theme congeals, and then they put the collection together around themes that emerge from the 20 stories. But as we talked about last time, those 13 stories and these 11 stories feel like the theme was already there, and then you were kind of consciously writing to, you know, what the future is going to look like if we take the next couple of steps. And this, as you say, you know, had this really wonderful immigration story. It had an opioid-esque kind of story. You know, it had a lot of the natural things that we're battling in everyday life and we're reading about in the news. We could, you know, see little mirrored worlds in these stories. And I was wondering if the theme drove the stories, if the idea drove the stories. You know, I'm gonna tackle immigration, I'm gonna tackle opioids, and that's kind of your point of entry for a lot of these, or if it came about a different way, if these stories came about a different way.
You know, it tends to come about a different way. As a personal, you know, my personal life as a human being living in the society, these things disturb me very much, and I do want to write about them, but I have to pull that urge back because the problem with writing moralistic fiction or fiction that has morals in it is that you can very quickly become preaching, you know, and you use your characters as a soapbox in some ways to stand on, and I think it can really, for me at least, kill the stories. And so that is in my subconscious, and I hope that I will be able to address the stories. But the way that my creativity seems to work is that it gives me these other images, sometimes characters or setting or conflict. So, for example, Sanctuary with the mantids, that came because I was using virtual reality, and there was something glitching on the left side of my vision, and it looked like this mantid, and that was really spooky and a little unsettling. So I dove into that and started to explore it. And as I was writing, having no clue, you know, why was I writing about enormous grasshoppers in the virtual world? What was I going to do? That's the inner part of my writer, you know, the control part thing. What is the story about? Mm-hmm. I try to ease that and keep writing, and then suddenly I realized, oh, it's immigration. That helps me then sculpt it at that point and figure figure out a little bit of the beginning, middle, end. But again, I try to not force that or keep that at the forefront because I want the story to be organic and provide metaphors that I wasn't controlling in some ways that come up from the material itself.
It's so funny you should say that because I remember Children of the Lesser World came about because your computer crashed, right?
That's right.
So I'm loving that your computer is sort of this instrument that's kind of guiding your writing and telling you this is what you need to be writing about. Like it's sending little messages to you, like here's where you should go, right? I'm going to put a little grasshopper in the corner of your vision over here, or I'm going to crash and make you think about things here. I mean, I just think that writer's relationship with their computer and the creative material that's generated out of it for you is really interesting in and of itself, given the topics that you're writing about.
Yeah, it's funny how it works. I mean, I'm very thankful that my subconscious works that way.
Yeah.
It's rare. Like, there's the shortest story in here is We Only Wanted Their Happiness in the new collection. And that story involves children that end up begging their parents for implants. You know, they just want it, and finally the parents give the children implants. And then the children become monsters and recede into the implant world, and the parents can't get them out of it. And that just came about because I was really frustrated with my teenage son for not getting off the computer when he was playing Fortnite. As many parents out there share this, horror of Fortnite. And it was just so frustrating. You know, I'd make dinner, and the way Fortnite works, it could be 5 minutes or it could be an hour when, you know, if you say turn it off now, it's this new gaming kind of time that kids are playing with where, no, they're in a campaign with a bunch of other people. They can't get out of this. And that angst and that frustration drove me immediately to pen and paper, and I just, you know, started writing about these implanted children that I could no longer be reached.
There's a lot of fathers, there was in the first collection as well, there's a lot of parent-child relationship stories here. And the interesting thing to me about Universal Love is there's a lot of stories in here where the children are almost parenting the parents. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's the children that are saying, you know, maybe you should pull back a little bit, or hey, this is where this is going. And that relationship, which I've noticed in my own relationship with my teenage daughter, is very real, that she's almost the one sometimes saying, you better watch what you're doing there, because, you know, you might not realize the full ramifications because they came up with it and they've maybe had this stuff on their mind even more than we have who, you know, are later adopters and total addicts.
Yeah.
I think that relationship is really interesting, and the book really explored that really well.
Yeah, and I noticed that too. I mean, in Children of the New World, there was really a feeling of the parents are protecting the kids. The parents are trying to keep them away, even though the parents are getting addicted. And this is, in many ways, the natural progression of that. It's also what I see in my own relationship with my son, where the kids know this technology better. I think that they are, in some ways, much more savvy about the addiction in there. They're aware, at least, that the producers of this are creating addictive technology. I don't think that makes them any more hesitant to use it.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they certainly are. My son, for example, will tell me, no, exactly like you say, I wouldn't do that. And he's the first listener to my stories because he will tell me, no, actually, Snapchat already does that. That's not a futuristic technology yet, or something horrifying like that. And so he's giving me advice in a very meta way. He's giving me advice about the technology as I write these stories.
Yeah, we talked about that last time, too, when he was 3 years younger, and he was still giving you advice. He was still your first reader back then, kind of advising you where technology was going. That's interesting. The other thing – go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, it's funny, though, because – he doesn't necessarily recognize when I read him We Only Wanted Their Happiness. He was like, those kids are monsters. I was like, you do realize that this is about cell phones and Fortnite? He was like, oh, yeah, I guess, sure.
Okay. The story that really stuck out at me in that regard was Purple Heart, you know, where this is a story you can introduce it better than I can, but essentially that the father and son enter this game where, you know, killing people is an actual reality, and you can do it from the comfort of your living room while you're eating potato chips and with droids, or drones, rather. Sorry. Yeah, I mean, that really struck me the most about where the parent-child collusion in technology alongside, like, I'm trying to protect you. The son was kind of trying to protect the dad. And, you know, they're both into this game that has much higher consequences than a video game, I thought. Tell me about the origin of that story, where that began, and if it became something that you weren't expecting.
So that story came out of my son wanting a game called Just Cause 3. And this is a real video game. It exists. It's not virtual reality. But the premise of this video game is that you are kind of a renegade soldier for hire, I suppose, that's going in to liberate a, in this case, I forget what the full backstory is, but a country that's under a dictatorship, and you're going in there with bazookas and guns and parachutes and bodysuits, and you just blow up everything, right? You're blowing up gas stations and makes these enormous explosions. Well, he wanted that, and they said, absolutely not. You know, you can't have this. This is way too violent, et cetera, et cetera. He asked. Finally said, okay, fine, but, you know, you can't use, you know, I said all these rules that were arbitrary. You can't use your grappling hook to tether people to cars or, you know, this sort of malicious stuff you could do in this game. Well, we're playing it, I'm watching it, and he says, do you want to turn? And I start to play it, and like the dad in Purple Heart, I really suck at this new game where I used to be great at Nintendo. And I was embarrassed. You know, everybody was attacking me. I was looking up at the sky and, you know, played for 3 seconds, essentially. And so after he left, you know, to go to his mother's, I then spent the weekend trying to polish my skills on this game. And before I knew it, I was hooked. I didn't care about the violence anymore. I was grappling, you know, people to cars or whatever I needed to do, blowing things up. And I became completely addicted to this game. And he eventually got tired of the game and moved on. And I was still playing it, staying up late at night. And I was just watching myself as I did this and saying, this is really bizarre. And this is definitely material for a short story. And so I become the dad in that game.
So great. My guest this morning is Alexander Weinstein. The book we are talking about is Universal Love. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I've been talking lately with authors just about what fiction can do over nonfiction. And for all of the nonfiction books out there about technology and where we're going and the, I'm trying to think of the singularity is Ray Kurzweil, the singularity is new guy. So you can accomplish things, I think, in fiction, get people's attention in fiction, I think, in a way that you can't really as well in nonfiction. I mean, obviously you can intellectually see where we're going in nonfiction, but you can't viscerally feel it the way you can in these stories. Mm. And, I just think there's such a power of being able to reach people and reach inside their imagination and give them a flavor for what this is really going to feel like and really going to, the implications of all of this in ways that you can never reach them in nonfiction. And, you know, I just wanted to really give a kind of a shout out to science fiction and what it's able to do in a, you know, very not too distant future and what you think the power and importance of fiction is in our current environment.
Yeah, I think one of the benefits, at least one of the things that I try really hard in my stories to accomplish is the human aspect, right? Bringing us into the characters and that these characters are immediately familiar and relatable to us as human beings, as people who love each other, who struggle with love, who try to raise kids, and that's the part that I'm really bringing into that. And that we get involved in that, I think, then brings up the fears. Once I can then bring in the technology, if we recognize, oh, that's our own life with our children, that's our life of disconnection with our parents, that can then grab hopefully readers by sort of the heart and create a kind of fear that we want, you know, that I'd like us to have as a society. The problem I've been finding is that a lot of my predictions are coming true. So that's I'm almost wondering if I should make cheerier or rosier predictions given the dystopian times we find ourselves in.
You're wielding a lot of power to make these to make these things happen. Are you influenced? I mean, I feel like you must have been a big Twilight Zone watcher or a Black Mirror watcher, some of these things that reminded me so much of your worlds that I'm also addicted to on the screen.
You know, I wasn't really into science fiction. It's interesting. I don't have a background in science fiction. But I totally fell in love with Black Mirror. My work was compared to it so often that I finally said, okay, let me see what everyone's talking about. And immediately I was like, oh, the, you know, we're talking about the same things. These are the warnings. I really love the series Black Mirror. But, yeah, as far as my reading goes and my background in science fiction, it's really been missing, I think. And I'm coming to it now as the sci-fi community is really embracing these stories and the work.
That's funny. Because I've been grabbing people lately and telling them about the collection as I've been reading it. And they're, you know, the responses you must always hear, too, is, oh, that sounds like Black Mirror.
Yeah, completely. I know, it's really funny. I look forward to one day sitting down and talking with the creators of Black Mirror. It seems like we share a lot of the same ideas about where we're heading.
Did I see somewhere that Children of the New World is making its way to the screen? I thought I saw somebody's directing it.
It is. That's the big news. This year, the story Sing Goodbye to Yang is coming out. It's called After Yang, starring Colin Farrell and from A24 Studios. And so it's going to be a major motion picture.
Great.
And I actually got to go to New York and see the filming and meet Yang and meet all the different characters. It was like reuniting with old family members or something. It was really surreal and very very beautiful experience.
How much involved are you in? Are you at all involved in the screenplay?
You know, I'm not very much. I mean, the director and I, spoke and spent time together, and he asked me some different questions about, you know, where I saw the work and suggested a couple different directions that he was taking. And some of them I said, sounds great. Other ones he said, what do you think? And we sort of worked out what might be a problem with one direction or another. But that outside of that conversation, I really leave it to the directors and screenwriters to do all of that work because they know that form so well. And I just trust them inherently with that, another story that's on its way to Hollywood is Children of the New World, the director Lulu Wang, who did The Farewell, and so this is her next project. And we've been speaking over the years a lot about these questions of intimacy and how technology affects family intimacy and love and relationships. And so there's that kind of brainstorming that goes into this too, where really what we're talking about is the themes more than the actual writing of the scripts.
Right. I love that short stories can make full-length feature films. That is sort of an insight into what 20, 25 pages can accomplish, that you can burst it open and there's enough space in there and enough content in there to carry, you know, a full-length feature film. I'm thinking of like Shawshank Redemption or something, or Brokeback Mountain. That's how dense and compressed and tight short stories are written, that, you know, there's still enough air in there to carry what a novel carries almost, you know. Like if you extrapolate out, it's all in there. It's just compressed down to its essence. That's really cool. Cool.
Yeah, and it might be that, you know, because of that compression, there's all of this ability to take some of those details in new directions, since it's not, you know, written in that way, right? So there's, you give the, as a short story writer, a lot of times I have to give the shadow of where it's heading, right? The setting, I do brushstrokes to make it feel like a complete world, But there's so much more extrapolation available there, and that's where the creative collaboration of the scriptwriter, the director, can really step in and use their creativity.
Right, right. You seem as comfortable in a women's voice, in women's heads, as you do in men's. I was kind of dissecting both collections, but the most recent one, of course, is pretty kind of split between female and male point of view. You tackle young person point of view, you know, little kid point of view. And I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about accessing some of these voices who, if characters who are biographically very different from you tend to come easier to you, or if it's, you know, like the father in Purple Heart where you can really map yourself onto that. Talk a little bit about accessing some of these characters and their voices.
Yeah, I'm so happy to hear that you feel I did it successfully, because it was a, you know, I stayed away in the first, in Children of the New World, I stayed away from writing from a female perspective, specifically because I was very conscious of the, I guess, potential politics in that, right? Mm-hmm. That I didn't want to usurp voices or, you know, in some ways, there was a kind of a question about, did I have the right to, as a male to write that way? And so I was trying to be really conscious about that. And then some of the feedback I got was, they're all written from male points of view, right? And so I said, oh, no. And so this time, I had that in the back of my head. Again, here's that subconscious part of my creative process. I had in the back of my head that, okay, it would be really nice, you know, if there were female points of view here, or for that matter, straight character. The first collection has all straight characters. You know, I just wanted the diversity of voices. And I didn't approach the stories like, I'm going to write this story from a female point of view. I actually many times was writing the male characters, and then they started speaking to me in the middle of the process, and the names would change. You know, I'd want to name John or whatever, and I mean, nope, my voice is female, I'm a female. Hmm. Or I'd be writing a straight relationship, and then the characters just really began changing. As I was writing, it kept being like, no, David is my lover. You know, I didn't, at that point, I just let it go. And I just started writing to what those characters wanted to say. And I hoped I did it right. You know, that was the, and so I had a lot of readers read and give me feedback on how I was doing. And I just leaned into, again, the shared heart of our experiences of what it means to want love, of to be afraid of loss or afraid of rejection, loneliness. These kind of emotions that I think cut through us all.
Since you brought up this point of appropriation, I just want to lean into that a minute, because this is on so many people's tongues in the last couple of weeks for reasons obvious. And, you know, it felt like a couple of years ago that was a huge topic, and then it kind of seemed, the conversation seemed a little quieter, and now it's louder again with American Dirt. And I was just wondering if, through this experience and you being so sensitive to writing from other points of view, I mean, I feel like if we don't have some authority to write from some, you know, if we can only write from our own perspective, literature is going to be pretty narrow and we're not going to be able to say too much. But, you know, I'm also sensitive to the other side of that argument. And I was just wondering if you have generalized thoughts on that, on who kind of has the authority to write what, and if you feel like gender and sexuality are kind of safe grounds to explore, where race might not be as much, or do you feel like there are places that writers are allowed to go or they aren't allowed to go?
You know, I definitely feel that there's the pressure of not going there, right? And that is very much part of the conversation, and I feel that. I feel that conversation. I feel that pressure. It's certainly something that is very present in the MFA workshop and in blogs and in literature and in the social conversations that we're having. I don't know that I have an opinion, so to speak, as like what everybody should write out there and what's allowed and what shouldn't be allowed. for me, I, like I said, I was really very, I guess, self-editing early on. And the way that I gained, like, it's okay to do this is really because the characters themselves spoke to me. And I felt like I would be misrepresenting them in many ways, that I would be colonizing them, right, or really forcing them into a straight male voice, which would be the worst thing to do. That would seem like the most egregious error of this conversation if I was saying, nope, you're not a woman, you are male, and you're going to, you know, be that character. That felt wrong to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think part of it comes down to how well is it done, how sensitively is it done, to what extent does it actually speak to the experiences,
yeah,
effectively, that readers feel that and that can experience that. And so that's part of fiction, you know, especially when I look at the larger picture of, as a speculative fiction writer, I have to also create worlds that depend on the readers believing that it's done well, right, and the believing in those worlds. And if that's effective and it moves people, for me that's really the most important part of that. Certainly if we're talking about taking publishing spots away from other writers or stealing the voices of other writers, that's an incredibly important discussion to have and something that needs change.
Yeah. That was kind of an unfair question, so I appreciate you answering that so honestly and thoughtfully. That's true. And you really bring up a great point about when you're building the worlds you're building here, which are similar to ours, but enough different that, you know, we kind of have to learn the rules all over again for these characters. That's really what's important and what's difficult. And you have to buy into all of that. And so you're right. That's what's underlying all of these stories, is this really intricate, you know, world building, future building, so that the reader already has to make that leap into that world. And then, of course, you'd make the leap into whatever character is going to move through that world the most effectively, you know. So that's well observed. To that point, I would love, we talked a little bit about this last time, but we didn't have that much time to explore it, of how you so effectively build these worlds without being, you know, didactic and explainy. And you were so insightful on this the last time that I just wanted to open that conversation back up, because it's hard. And I went back to read how you did it on, and I guess that's the best way to educate our listeners today, is just pick up the book and see how you did it. But I would love for you to talk a little bit about kind of what guides you in terms of how you set the reader down in these, you know, slightly foreign places, without, you know, explaining to them, this is how this works and this is how this technology works.
Yeah, that's such a big part for me of writing world building, is not doing the info dump, right? Avoiding that info dump, or avoiding large swaths of jargon or technological language that's going to somehow exclude the reader. And granted, I do think that there is some hard sci-fi, hard fantasy, where you really have a reader base that wants that and enjoys that. But for me, it ties down the story too much in the technology, in the premise. And I always want to keep refocusing us on the human. So that one way is that I background all of the technology, right? So much like I wouldn't spend, if I was writing realism and I said my phone was ringing, I took out my phone. It was a cell phone, which used to be a landline, but had been discovered and, you know, went through this whole thing. It would be a ridiculous moment. I don't want to do that with futuristic technology. And so part of the world building is expecting that the reader, or including the reader, in the future world that I want. And I base the technology largely on things that we already know. Right, and so it's really an extrapolation of these technologies we already have. And for me, then, part of how you do that is, I almost think of it as a breadcrumb trail, right? You jump in. I think it's okay to leave the reader slightly confused, but intrigued, right? So they're kind of catching on, holding on. What was that? That's really strange. What does that mean? but they're in the story enough that they can wait just a little bit longer, and then you give another breadcrumb of explanation.
Yes.
And that's through trying never to do that explanation through exposition, which for me is the info dump, but rather through action, through setting, through conflicts with the technology itself, and piece that out throughout so that by around the middle of the story, the reader feels like they've gotten all of the necessary info to understand the world they're in.
I'll just read, but yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, that's, for writers, I think that's that balance of, like, how do you make sure you don't lose the reader? Because at any point, if you give either too little information or an overload and too much information, you risk losing your reader.
Right, right. There's one story in here that just starts, the story is childhood. They arrived in boxes on a rainy August morning, their ETA marked on their parents' calendar with the words Joe and Lacey's birthday. Which just tells us, you know, they're a robot. They're not human. And that's just an example of what you're telling us here, which is, you know, the information is delivered without you even knowing information is being delivered, and it's just being understood as this is part of the world, and you're now introduced to these two characters who you know came out of a box.
That's right. And that is sculpted in that way, where I'm thinking, okay. You know, it's trusting the reader to be equally, like, smarter than I am, right, in some ways. Like, okay, if I mention a box, you'll get that point. In that same story, there's this issue of these emotion chips, right, that are pressed into you under the slit in the armpit. The children have these emotion chips where they get all their emotions of love or compassion or rebelliousness. And that's a really technical thing that I have to figure out how to explain to the reader, because, you know, that's a key part of that story, since the children find out they can scrape those emotion chips and smoke them to get high. And that then I have this problem, for example, of how do I present that? And I think how I work on hiding my info dumps or the exposition is I put it immediately into scene. And so when would that emotion chip be accessed? Well, it would be accessed, you know, shortly after going into a new grade. And so then you have this scene where the mother is replacing the emotion chip, and we can then watch what happens when an emotion chip is removed from a robot body or from this child's body and what it feels like when it's replaced. And that allows me to build on the technology while really focusing on that intimate scene between the mother and the child.
This might be a good story to take. I was thinking of doing the first story, but I always like with short story writers to take a story out of the collection and talk about, you know, original kernel of the idea, how many drafts it went through, if you recognize the story as printed in the book from whatever you thought it was going to be when you first started it, and kind of walk us through that revision process. I don't know if there's a story in here that gave you the most trouble, that you had to revise the most times, that, you know, gave you fits. But maybe childhood is a good example to take, since we're already kind of into it, of where that story, the original kernel, and kind of how you kept massaging it, how many drafts it went through, and you know, how it changed from origin idea to conclusion.
Yeah, that was a story that really changed from, because the first line was, the first thing he saw was the guns, right? And so that actually starts in a much later scene. I thought the story was going to begin with this boy who has to go rescue his sister from some very unsavory sort of cybernetic drug folks, and they have all these guns, which he knows can destroy him, right? The guns can really blow apart these robots. And so I started writing it that way, and pretty quickly into it, I realized that I was setting myself up to write a story that was going to have to be a lot of backstory, because if I was starting in that moment, which actually now appears almost near the end, a couple pages from the end, mm-hmm. I would then have to go back in time, I'd have to do all this retrospective, it was going to get pretty heavy as far as exposition went. And I also, for a long time, didn't want to write that story. It seemed too dark. In that scene, the boy discovers all these other robotic bodies that have been taken apart, and it was such a dark, almost horror-style scene that was there that I just put it off for the longest time. I was like, I don't want to write this. And then one night, that sat around for about a year, where I was just pushing it, actively pushing away, no, I don't want to write this. I woke up in the middle from dreams in the middle of the night, and suddenly I had this vision of these children arriving in boxes. And so even though it was 2 a.m., I got out my pen and paper, and I pretty much wrote the whole draft at that point, start to finish, until about 5 in the morning or 6 in the morning, which is part of my practice. That one of my rules is I have to write when I have the clear vision or the inspiration of it. That was a mess of a draft. It was all over the place. And then it took, it takes about 20 drafts, I think, before I get it into shape where I can start to see it. And then different parts get added in. The principal scene, where the principal is telling the parents about the problems of smoking, emotion chips, that was new. And I knew where I wanted to end at that point, so that let me work towards that. But that took another 6 months to a year to shape that story.
Don't you love the subconscious and what it's...
I'm very reliant on it.
Yeah. And I love that you get up at 2 in the morning. I mean, the thing about that, A, is that the subconscious is way more interesting than the conscious mind, I think, and it's driving the story. And it also gives you kind of this freedom to really play around. As you say, if every sentence doesn't sound perfect and it's a big hot mess, it doesn't matter. All this interesting stuff is coming out of it that maybe... at the hot light of noon while your brain is alive and caffeinated would not be as easily accessible. You'd be editing yourself way more maybe than you would at 2
a.m. That's part of my process, is to overwrite and allow myself to really play and explore. It makes for a harder edit because most of my stories, in their original drafts, are probably 40 pages or even 50 pages. And so I'm cutting out major swaths and whole scenes that I thought I just loved and were perfect. They have to go because they don't ultimately serve the story.
And the last time we talked, you were also talking about overwriting the technology. And that probably is necessary just so you understand how the technology works. And then you can, get it down to its bare bones.
Very much so. Yeah. Also with dialogue, I do the same. I mean, I write so much extra dialogue. And the trick is that my writer self, the part that likes to be inspired, thinks it's great, it's all so perfect, I have a character finally speaking for 3 pages. It's like that becomes, you need 5 sentences. Get rid of 2.5 pages of that dialogue. And so it distills down. But I tell you, one of the hardest stories for me to write in this collection was Islanders, because that story I actually had completed. I had written the whole story. I write by hand, and I had it in a notebook, and I left the notebook on an airplane.
Dear God.
And so, and it's a very different kind of story, actually, for me. It really felt like a different emotion register and setting, and I lost it all. Oh. And I never got that back.
And you have a history of this.
What's that?
I said, you have a history of this.
I do. Did this happen? Oh, yeah, with the computer crashing.
Yeah.
And so that was brutal, because every time I sat down to write that story, I always thought that the original was better. And my guess is that it wasn't. I really would be so interested if that journal ever comes back to me to find out, to compare the two stories.
Yeah. Fascinating. Talk a little bit about endings, because I feel like endings in short stories are very different than novel endings, that you kind of have to end things with a mysterious, what's going to happen, kind of unsettling ending. I think short stories benefit from more than, if you did that in a novel, your readers would kill you with stakes. So when you talk about kind of finding the... when you know you've landed on the right note, if you feel it, viscerally or kind of finding those endings.
It is a visceral feeling that comes ultimately. I think a lot of times when you try to find information on how do you end something, you get this like, well, you just have to feel it. It's a bump. It's not very helpful at all to writers. But the truth is that there is this kind of internal logic to the story, and if you're paying close attention to the sentence structure and the mood of it, you know, for me, I will suddenly feel, and it feels like a bump, you know, which is like, oh, that was the ending. I almost always have that. And then I keep writing, you know, because I don't trust it. Because I want, I have actually a lot of fake endings, it turns out, because I think it has to end here. And so I'll be working towards this ending, and I'll actually hit the natural ending, and then I'll write another three pages. Because I really want this ending that, you know, I originally envisioned.
Uh-huh.
Part of what determines that that's unnecessary, well, one, it's my, you know, I get feedback from editors that say that's all unnecessary. But the other part is looking at what is the, at what point have I actually said the things that I need to? At what point does the reader understand the whole situation of the characters? And so having this extra part in there is really just superfluous. For me, part of the problem is that I always want to try to get, a lot of times I want happy endings. And so I will write a happy ending, and then my editors will say, this is not believable.
Mm-hmm.
You did not set yourself up for a happy ending, and you need to cut that. And I always, you know, want to fight, but I know they're right, because I can hear it, and I can say, no, nope, that is indeed how it's going to end. I agree with what you're saying. I think tying, I try not to tie everything up neatly.
Yeah.
It's rare. And so part of how, you know, technically how can you do that, I think, is you can work with language. You know, you can look at if you've been doing a lot of short sentences, moving into more poetic, kind of zoom back poetic description can really give the feeling of an ending. And so there's even technical ways on the line level that you can create a sense of an ending.
Interesting. It's funny now, I'm flushing back over the whole collection, trying to think if any of them really had happy endings. I mean, my feeling about the stories was certainly not happy endings, but I guess some of them ended a bit hopefully, but the whole area of concern of all the stories was so dismal. I always had to take, I had to take a lot of time after each story was over to, you know, as much as I loved every single one, I was like, oh, I need a minute. I need to.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, for me, I think Beijing, as dark of an ending one might say, is where Beijing ends. It is aimed at a moment of hope for this character. Right? This, the line ends with him taking his first breath, and that is to symbolize that there is an opportunity for something to get better there. Right? Now, that's a small note of hope. Probably comfort porn is a more happy ending, so to speak, or at least there's potential of this discovery of friendship near the end, and the and that things might get better.
Yeah.
There, right. But it is true that it's often that things might get better, not like here we are in happy land. And that's very interesting to me as an author. Of you know, I think this goes back to something we were talking about earlier, that in a politically, socially problematic, dystopian, horrific, depends what adjective you want, society, happy endings can seem very false or can have political weight that doesn't really represent where we find ourselves.
And our bar for happiness has probably gotten so low. You know, we're just taking a breath at the end of Beijing seems, oh, that's so nice. Our happy bar was very high, you know, 8 years ago maybe, and now it's just like in the toilet, and you're like,
right. Well. You can actually breathe in a polluted environment. You can get a single breath. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my
yay.
Goodness. Yay. Yeah, right.
But some days it does feel that way. I tell you, if you in the news cycle, it's really...
No, absolutely.
Know,
yeah.
I think that's how many of us emotionally feel.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. In our last few minutes, can you talk a little bit about... for those who don't have the luxury of an MFA, kind of how, what you would prescribe as kind of the best way to educate yourself as a writer, like if it's reading within your genre or reading writing books or just, you know, writing or finding writers groups, kind of where have you found you kind of get the most bang for your buck as a writer to educate yourself on writing well?
I do think the first part is really important. You should read as much as you can and write as much as you can. And part of when I teach, a great deal has to do with getting rid of the inner critic and just allowing the inner writer to play, you know, and to make a mess. and to get rid of this idea that you're going to write the great American novel and every line has to be perfect. But at a certain point, if you're doing that and you're writing, it is important to get a writing community around. And so finding other writers, especially if you don't have that support, right? If you think, am I crazy for writing? It's very helpful to have other writers around. I think there is a lot of, you know, I started the Martha's Vineyard Institute of Creative Writing to nurture a space like that. And so there are summer conferences and retreats that you can go to, and many of them are, sometimes they're exclusive, right? But a lot of them, for example, I try to create a lot of fellowships for writers so that there's actual funding to be able to do that. And that can be really helpful. Because I do think that you have to be careful of small writing groups that will always tell you you're doing great. That's wonderful at first, but at a certain point you want a critical edge to look at that. And that critical edge, in my opinion, should be compassionate and nurturing so that it doesn't shut down the creative process at that point.
Right, right. There are a lot of, well, there are so many wonderful retreat sort of things. I mean, Squaw is on our coast and... yeah, there's a lot of those. There are also a lot of just really cool adult extension classes or whatnot, you know, offered. There's a lot of essay workshops and things, it seems like, in either community colleges or colleges around that, you know, at least writers can, if you're just starting to explore it, you can see if it's something that's going to be a good fit for you.
Yeah, and often, like you say, there's a Rec-N-Ed in the town that's offering something. And it's hit or miss, you know, it always depends on the teacher and on who's leading that. And so I think you have to trust your gut, too. If that teacher, if that workshop is helping you produce and moving you forward, great. If it's not, if it's leaving you feeling belittled or ashamed of your own work, that's probably not a good place for you.
Right, right. Alexander Weinstein, I love these. You're going to have to write fast so we get to do this again, because I just love them. And we can find you online. You're at alexanderweinstein.com. I went on there to see if you were coming to the West Coast, and I didn't see any dates. But
hoping to add a San Francisco stop in there. And so hopefully this spring I'll be coming out that way.
Excellent, excellent. So we can find you there. Is that the best kind of way to follow your work?
It is. You know, on there you can find my new publications. I try to hyperlink them when I have stuff that's available online.
Yeah.
And see the tour and where I'll be.
Wonderful, wonderful. Alexander Weinstein, thanks so much for taking the time today. This was wonderful.
Thank you so much. I have a great time speaking with you.
Thank you.